what we are mobilizing for right now isn't just to sustain the House and win the Senate and get the White House, but it's to keep up the momentum on the ground, because we're going to need an organized electorate in order to have sustainable change.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. Welcome. And thanks for joining us on this special edition of The Tightrope. I'm Tricia Rose, here with my co-host and friend, Cornel West. Today's episode of The Tightrope is what they call a takeover of the Intelligence Squared podcast. For those of you who don't know them, Intelligence Squared is a leading forum for discussion and debate with high-profile guests from around the world. So if you're watching or listening to this on The Tightrope, check out the Intelligence Squared podcast and the YouTube channel. And if you found us through Intelligence Squared, please take a look at the links to the Tightrope's podcast and channels in the description and subscribe. Today's guest is Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She represents Minnesota's 5th congressional district, which includes the city of Minneapolis. Before becoming a congresswoman 2 years ago, she was an experienced Twin City policy analyst and community organizer. She's one of only 2 Muslim American women elected to Congress, the first Somali American member of Congress, and the first woman of color to represent Minnesota. Representative Omar, thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Tightrope.
It is an honor to be here with you today.
We're thrilled to have you. I just want to start off, I know we don't have a lot of time with you today, and I just wanted to start off with, you know, how you're doing, how your family's doing. I know everyone's wondering, you know, you're running around on the trail, but also how's your constituencies doing? What's on the ground where things are right now?
I mean, we're all holding on. You know, I represent a district that includes all of Minneapolis and 14 other surrounding municipalities. And as many of you know, Minneapolis has been ground zero for the response our communities have had to police brutality after the murder of George Floyd in the hands of the Minneapolis police. And so there's a lot of trauma that has been unearthed. There's a lot of pain. People were already struggling because of the public health pandemic and the financial crisis that it brought. And now, you know, there's just a lot of other pain that people are going through. But we're resilient here in Minneapolis, and we are a community that thrives on solidarity. And so we have been holding on to one another and helping each other through not just the pandemic, but the financial crisis. And now, you know, dealing with systematic racism and police brutality.
Yeah, well, you've got your hands full, for sure.
Indeed. Well, we are just so blessed to have you with us. It's so wonderful to have somebody who's so courageous and so consistent and so compassionate when it comes to the least of these in the biblical sense, the ones catching hell, oppressed folk here and around the world. How do you read this present moment, though? I mean, we've got this kind of neo-fascism escalating. We need to push the gangster out of the White House. And yet at the same time, we've got contestation among the coalition itself. Well, how do you read this moment?
Yeah. I mean, we have to remember, right, that we didn't arrive in this moment by accident. Everything that we are living through and, you know, thinking of as a painful moment in our history was ushered in by decades of social and economic neglect, by systems that weren't designed for many of us to not survive and thrive. And, you know, we have had decaying, really, of our systems of democracy and our morality that has let its way into allowing someone like the president that we currently have to come to power. And, you know, I was reminiscing about, you know, my arrival here in the United States. And I was thinking about how my father would have reacted if someone told him that, you know, someday we would have a president unhinged enough to use his daughter's name in every rally and conversation to stir up hate. But that also the American people would vote for someone who would not only neglect to fully address a public health crisis, address, you know, an economic crisis that's bringing on devastation onto people, but would take joy in unearthing trauma for people and sort of thriving in dividing our nation and not uniting it. And I said, you know, my dad would have told him to seek help. because I think, you know, to many of us, we continue to be stuck in this moment where we're analyzing this situation from a decency point of view, right? Like, how did we get here? How would our country, our fellow countrymen and women, would allow someone like this president to come to power? But if you look at the complacency that has been part of our systems for so long, for so many people, it's not that surprising. There isn't that much to analyze. We haven't invested in strengthening our communities. We haven't invested in strengthening our democracy. We haven't invested in making a representative democracy actually represent its people. And we haven't invested in having, you know, the mechanisms to allow for, you know, government to be of the people and for the people. And so now, do we not only have fascism at our doorsteps, but we also have a system that is, for the first time, I would say, in the open, sort of robbing the American people. And, you know, every single day somebody says, why can't you hold him accountable? Why isn't this administration accountable? And we can't, because we haven't really invested in strengthening our accountability measures to stop someone from exploiting them.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, what you say there really puts into broader context of the crisis that we're facing regarding not just the moment, but this legacy of neglect and this legacy of certain kinds of racialized corruption in particular. So I'm wondering if you could focus this issue in on George Floyd and all of the institutional mechanisms and systemic forces that you described, that you referenced, you know, that brought him into the situation he was in. Because, you know, some conservatives and others might say, you know, listen, it's a Democratic leader in the town. Right. The district was a Democratic district. You know, how is it that this could happen to George Floyd in what would be considered, a relatively liberal context? But can you unpack what you were just saying in relation to that? Because I think people need to hear why this isn't just a matter of individual institutions being able to respond to this kind of crisis.
Yeah, I mean, we are seeking to have equal access to systems that were created without us in mind. And so it doesn't really matter the amount of reforms we carry on if the whole system is sort of designed to not grant you access to opportunity and prosperity, access to your civil liberties, access to your full humanity, access to dignity. You know, people think of Minnesota as a liberal haven, and it is for a lot of people, but it's also one of the worst states for Black people to live in. Every single study has shown that Minnesota Wisconsin and Illinois are the worst three states for Black people to live. And that's not because the people in power haven't done the work of trying to reform these systems, is that the systems themselves didn't imagine people like us living here and didn't create systems to fully allow us to exist as ourselves, fully equal to everyone else. And so you will see the disparities because the systems aren't designed to educate our children. The systems aren't designed to create economic investment in our communities. The systems aren't designed to adequately absorb us into society. And, you know, the kind of transformation that is needed is asking of people to do something that they haven't done before. And there is fear amongst many because their way of life feels threatened when you are asking for them to, you know, expand their thought process and to reimagine a system where everybody's way of life is protected and uplifted.
Yes. You know, it just strikes me that one of the historically unique callings that you have and have been able to execute in such a powerful way is to try to convince folk on the ground that that system was not designed for them. It's almost like Martin Luther King. You call for revolution, fundamental change in priority, shift of power and wealth from those at the top to everyday people. But you also are able to do that inside of the very system itself. So you got this inside outside dialectical dance that is so difficult to do. How do you pull that off, my sister?
You know, I'm an organizer. And so having that mindset and bringing that into the halls of power has allowed me to not forget, right, who I work for, where I came from, what it felt like to be out protesting and organizing people to see themselves as not only part of the system, but to see themselves as agents of change. And now that I am there, that's the only way I can see myself. And, you know, if we think about what Martin Luther King was fighting for and how he transformed, you know, even his messaging after the civil rights battle was won, was to speak about there is no good at, right, like having equality when he said, what is it to have a seat at the counter if you can't buy the burger?
Right. Right.
It is to understand that, you know, I don't just want you to see me as equal. I also want you to see me as deserving of equal opportunity and prosperity and everything that is part of the promise of America. And so for many of us, we recognize that our cries in the streets can be legislated, right? And we can, in the ways in which they have codified profit for corporations and prioritizing capitalist society, we can codify our opportunities for prosperity into law as well. We can codify our right to wealth and joy and dignity and humanity. And I know that that's a great task, but we are up to it.
Yeah, you are up to it. That is for sure. But what are some of the obstacles that may also be inside the Democratic Party, right? It's easy in these highly polarized voting presidential election contexts to think of it simply between two parties. But, you know, if Biden wins the White House and Democrats win the House and the Senate, you know, do you think that there'll be enough groundswell within the context of the Democratic Party to embrace the kinds of progressive visions for the kinds of opportunity that you just described?
Yes and no. I know that, you know, there is going to be a cohort within the Democratic caucus in Congress, whether it's in the Senate or in the House, that really is clear-eyed about what our objectives are in addressing the decades of social and economic neglect that many of our communities have experienced that have brought us to this moment and have been laid bare by the public health crisis. But I also know that what we are seeking to do hasn't been done before, and we will be faced with many obstacles, and a lot of people will try to go back to their traditional conversations about incremental change, and we can't move fast enough, we can't dream big enough, and we can't implement transformative change. But what we are mobilizing for right now isn't just to sustain the House and win the Senate and get the White House, but it's to keep up the momentum on the ground, because we're going to need an organized electorate in order to have sustainable change.
I mean, I think part of the challenge is, how do you get a Democratic Party where its major corporate wing is so tied to Wall Street and Pentagon militarism to focus on the predatory capitalism on the one hand, and that militarism abroad, the drones in Somalia and Yemen and so forth, and at the same time deal with the white supremacy and male supremacy at home, the homophobia and transphobia at home? Now, you have been able to speak with courage to each one of those issues. That's a rare thing for an elected official. Now, I know I don't want to just keep coming back to that point, but my dear sister, that's a rare thing, and it needs to be said and acknowledged and highlighted. And yet you've got to walk your own tightrope. We're glad to have you on our tightrope. But you got to walk your own tightrope daily, and you've been able to do it so well. And we just wonder, it's hard to say how that's going to unveil. We got to get the gangster out of the White House first. That's the crucial thing right now. But after, I think it is going to be a battle. And one wonders how that's going to proceed, though, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so I will say, you know, I think one of the most threatening things about me to not just the right, but to the establishment at large, is that the unique lens that I bring as someone who has lived outside of the United States, who had a window to the soul of America, and who now lives in America and is an American, who gets to see the soul of America from a different point of view, is that I know how we see ourselves, and I know that how other people see us, and there is a clear gap. And most of us have values and principles that don't allow us to want that gap to exist. And I think the awakening of that consciousness is really what has made me a threat to the powers that be, because it is an important awakeness that needs to happen. People have to be awakened from the complacency of believing that everything that we are doing outside of this country, that we seem to think is done out of a humanitarian point of view, isn't being viewed that way to the people we are trying to be, you know, responsive to and supportive to. And if we want that value to be carried out and those principles to be carried out, then we have to change the way that we carry out our missions of foreign engagement. And, you know, domestically, I think a lot of people also, you know, I know you talk about this, Bernie talks about this often, is that we don't make a clear connection about the economic devastations that we are living here in the United States, and those the least of us are bearing the burden of that economic devastation. And every time they ask for a cancellation of student debt, or they ask for an increase in the minimum wage, or they ask for, you know, a housing program that ends our homelessness, or they ask for more support for our veterans who are living on the side of the streets, or even, you know, addressing our climate crisis, people say, how can we afford it, right? How are we going to pay for it? And that conversation never takes place when it comes to our supporting our endless wars. It never comes to, you know, the billions of dollars we shell out every single year to the Pentagon. Those conversations aren't asked when we are talking about what defending our country looks like. But our defense is also domestic. And if we are to invest in creating a stronger society, that would ultimately make us safer and would lead to, you know, a more prosperous United States. You know, it's almost ironic and laughable that there are so many people who are coming out on an America First banner and rhetoric who are not interested in investing in raising the minimum wage, are not invested in addressing our climate crisis, are not invested in ending homelessness, are not invested in, you know, stopping Wall Street from robbing, you know, the American people blind, are not invested in, you know, stopping these endless wars and, you know, the bloating of the Pentagon budget. And, you know, the way that we get to do what you asked earlier is by continuing to emphasize that, you know, and sending out that message to the American people that our work has always been about putting people first. And, you know, the people who are telling you that we are somehow radical for wanting to feed our children and house our folks and create a livable planet are the ones that are not putting America first and are not the ones that are putting your lives first.
Wow, well put. Well put.
And so powerful.
This is
so
very
powerful.
Much so. I know you have a hard stop, and so we don't want to hold you up, especially because we know you're going off to do good things, and we hope your family stays safe and that, you know, with the last few days on this trail are treat you well. And we really hope you join us again on the tightrope. And we're also sharing this space with Intelligence Squared. So we welcome you back to either venue in the future. And we thank you again for joining us here on the tightrope today.
Yeah. Thank you both.
Well, we know that Ilana means beautiful voice, powerful voice. The Negro National Anthem is lift every voice as a prophetic Muslim voice and the legacy of Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali and so many others. We salute you and we are with you.
Thank you.
Boy, Cornell, that was an amazing conversation with Representative Omar. She is just a force for good and such an inspiration.
She's got a powerful intellect. She's got a strong spirit and a compassionate heart. She really does.
It was so impressive how she really transform this, you know, America First framework so that it really speaks to the everyday needs of everyday people, right? I mean, it was a terrific reframing that was quite inspiring.
That is so true. But when you look at the kind of cheap chauvinism of the American First and then apply a serious morally informed analysis of who actually lives in America. If you're not talking about poor people, working people, you're not talking about people who are catching hell, the America First ends up being a small little slice of America, usually on the vanilla side of the country, you see. And she just laid that out so well with such an eloquence that I'm so glad that we all could hear what she had to say.
Yeah, it was very moving and smart and truthful, you know, both.
Absolutely.
So it's time for our regular office hours with the students of the world. they are now in session. This week, we're going to talk about A Tale of Two Cities. And no, we're not going to read the novel, but we are talking about Tulsa and Minneapolis. there this week. We have some sad news, but important news about the discovery of additional mass graves in Tulsa, which is thought to be the final resting place of the Black victims of the Tulsa massacre, which took place nearly 100 years ago. And this is, we're going to discuss that, which is an office hours item in its own right. But we're also going to think about it in the context of Minneapolis, which had its own massacre this year, in a way. And we have some special footage from Andre Samples, who's one of our viewers. He lives on the same street where George Floyd was killed by police, and he sent us this video with an update.
Hey there, welcome to Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Heading down the street right now where I live, heading down towards the George Floyd Memorial, just down the way. It was a really interesting summer to be here, to be a part of this community. Right here on our street, right outside of our front door, we had lots of experiences with what we told our three-year-old were parades coming in front of our house, and we would bring her out and support people and be there with our community. A lot has happened. It hasn't always been easy, but it's been meaningful, and we're looking forward to the changes that will come out of this moment, because they will, because we need them to. All right, take care out there.
Mm. Wow. So Cornell, how did you feel about Brother Andre's words and how it might reflect on, you know, this question of trauma and what happens when these incidents take place? I mean, you have a personal relationship to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so tell us how you're thinking about these issues.
No, brother, he spoke from his heart, though, Brother Andre. You can see the resilience of his spirit that I hope resonates in all of us. But when you think about the novel, Tale of Two Cities, Dickens says the best of times are the worst of times. Well, for us, it's the worst and the worst. 1921, the vicious attack on Black folk. 2020, 99 years later, vicious attack on Black folk. The cycle goes on and on and on. But we've had cycles of resilience along with those cycles of attack and assault. I mean, the problem, I think, is that given the fact that we're still in a moment where we haven't been able to create any mechanisms of accountability of the police that are institutionalized, so that 1921, nobody was charged. 2020, we shall see. Nobody really charged yet, even though we got the process going, and we hope that Brother Keith Ellison and the others are able to bring the kind of powerful arguments to bear. But it just looks as if the accountability is always blocked for some reason when it comes to justice for Black people in America.
Yep, entirely true. And, you know, in addition to the role of state forces destroying Black businesses, you know, and harming Black communities then and now, you also have the freedom of the vigilantes who are free to, you know, participate in protests, stoke violence, and participate violently as well. And again, very little punishment, you know, if any. So you were born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Do you remember family stories about, you know, the massacre and the impact? Was there a kind of intergenerational resonance that you remember?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My grandfather arrived in Tulsa from a little hamlet called Hamburg, Louisiana, right outside of, Jennings? I forget exactly the name of the town up in Louisiana where he came from. But they told him he was crazy. They said, Clifton West, you've lost your mind to go to Tulsa. He said, they killing Black folk like I don't know what. He said, no, they lynching Black folk down here. So I got a choice between getting chased in Louisiana or take a chance in Tulsa. And my father was born 3 years later, 1928. So that was 7 years after the vicious attack, the massacre. And then I was born in 53, and I was always blessed. I'm very glad that I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the same hospital as the Wilson Brothers of the Gap Band, the Greenwood Arch and Pine Band, bringing the funk as well as the Silky Soul. And I would go every summer. My grandfather founded Metropolitan Baptist Church Northeast Tulsa, the chocolate side of Tulsa. It's, right now it's the biggest Black Baptist church, I'm told, in Tulsa. So it's going very strong with that beautiful picture of him on the wall. But Tulsa's always been a place, Oklahoma in general has been a place of very free, independent Black folk. Even the right wing that rules Tulsa now knows that you've got a number of Black folk there that are very free. They're just unable to be able to create some kind of organizational payoff. So in that way, Ralph Ellison's and the John Hope Franklin's, Charlie Christians, all that come out of Tulsa are associated with a certain kind of independence and autonomy and freedom. That's a beautiful thing. But the sad thing is, again, it's this cycle, though, Sister Tricia. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can you imagine at 2120, we'd be talking about another vicious attack on Black people 100 years again? You know, when is this thing going to stop? How do we stop it, you know?
You know, there's such a resilient narrative that justifies the violence, that normalizes it, that encourages allies to stand by and function ambivalently in relationship to this, you know, unregulated violence.
Very much so. Very much so. You know, Chief Sam came out of Oklahoma, who was a model for Marcus Garvey. Because Oklahoma, they attempted to make Oklahoma an all-Black, all-red state right before it became a state of the United States. And so you got all of these Black municipalities and Black towns of Muskogee and Langston and other places. Oklahoma was the place to go if you wanted to be a free Black person. The exodusters coming out of Jim Crow South often stopped and stayed in Oklahoma. And yet, when Chief Sam said Oklahoma not going to work, he went to Sierra Leone. He went to Africa. He took Black folk to Africa, and Garvey was deeply influenced by him. We got to leave the country if we can't be free here. And we don't have to accept Garvey's conclusion to recognize the realities that Garvey was pointing at and that Chief Sam was pointing at. Between a rock and a hard place, really. You have spent time in Tulsa, though, have you?
You know, I haven't spent any time in Tulsa. I know, you know, I've read plenty about the massacre, but you'd think I'd been to Tulsa. Well, I'm going to your granddaddy's church next time if I'm going to Tulsa.
And also
the home of the Gap Band. That's no joke.
Row. You put you on the front row. These are the special twosome right here.
I would love to go. I got to make it a trip now, because that's true. I've been so many places, but Oklahoma has not been a place I've visited as much as I should. So I know this much, that how much you're rooted there, I'm definitely going to go take a little trip. And as soon as we get done with this pandemic, Lord knows when that's going to be.
Tulsa, of all colors, a lot of good folk of all colors in Tulsa. It's just that the right wing folk are ruling in Tulsa. You know, it's Republican hegemonic across the board. But you got a lot of folk, good folk on the ground of all colors struggling there.
Yes, indeed. You know, one of the things that I think has been an important intervention lately is the use of arts and creative narrative to find creative ways to bring these kinds of critical historical events into public consciousness. You know, the opening of Regina King's Watchmen, the reboot of this HBO series called The Watchmen, which comes from basically a comic strip for all intent and purposes. But they open the whole scene with a reenactment pretty much of the Tulsa Massacre.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, it's the basis of the narrative. And so, you know, it becomes this really powerful way to recall it, to learn about it, to ask questions, to share it as a historical fact, but also as a creative reimagination. But it was a very powerful opening scene to the whole series. It's episode one, scene one, season one. Very powerful.
And one of the things about Tulsa was pointed out years ago by the great Ida B. Wells was that the attack on Black folk, it really began with an attack on the Black businesses. The Black businesses were out competing the white businesses. And so it became a matter of economics, became a matter of finances, became a matter of money. If we can crush these folk, we can take over not just their property, but their constituencies and markets of people who come to buy from them. And so even the predatory capitalism didn't want to be fair, didn't want to be just, didn't want to ensure that Black people had an opportunity to just sell like any other business person, you see. And so those, the catalyst had, was a personal thing in terms of a hotel, that, that generally speaking, it was an attack on these businesses. They burnt down the whole Black Wall Street. There was more Black wealth than any other place in the country. The Oklahoma Eagle, the great Black newspaper, was very much like the Pittsburgh Courier and the New York Amsterdam News. It was the major Black newspaper for the whole Black people all around the country, not just for Oklahoma.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think what's underneath this whole pattern is the effort to extract and dominate. And dominate. And you see it with mass incarceration, but it doesn't begin with mass incarceration, because with Tulsa, you have extract and dominate. And it, whether it's resources directly, as it was with Tulsa, right, to basically end the competition that Black businesses provided, or it's the profits of mass incarceration and the expansion of prisons, of police budgets, of, you know, private prisons, the entire expansion, which is what? Extract and dominate. And, you know, it seems to me that it's those connections we need to make, because Tulsa looks like the opposite of George Floyd, right? Or the opposite of the police brutality, right? But it's really not, not when you're thinking about it at the level of extraction and domination.
That's exactly right. And that domination includes exploitation, and that extraction includes expropriation, which is just stealing. But the stealing is not just in the abstract. It's stealing in regard to property, money, labor, all of the various ways in which material issues get connected with the cultural and the social issues. You know, our dear sister Nancy Fraser, one of the great critical theorists of our day, she always talks about this dialectical interplay between what you're talking about: expropriation, exploitation, extract, domination. And we have to be able to think about all of them interconnected. Now, that's a certain kind of intersectionality that we need to accent, in addition to what our dear sister Kimberly Crenshaw has taught us.
I mean, I would use a systemic racism framework for that, because in order, because the question is, what's the glue that unites the systemic practices across various aspects of a given society, right? And the glue is not so much a policy, but a set of principles and a set of emphases, right? Extraction and so on. And that's what I think unites it. I mean, of course, it's intersectional as well. I wouldn't reject that. In terms of thinking of it as a system that reproduces the same kinds of outcomes over and over and over. Right. So first, you know, during slavery, it was controlling Black women's reproduction by forcing Black women to reproduce. Then at other points in history, it's about using the refusal of allowing Black women to reproduce and using controlling their reproduction through criminalization. You know, then there's, you know, literally using the healthcare profession to control and dominate women's reproductive rights for other political reasons. But, you know, those distinctions fall away again, right? The actual behaviors could be the opposite. But when you look at them, actually, the outcomes, they produce the same thing: extraction, control, domination, et cetera. So to me, you know, a systemic analysis helps us see that it's like, what are the gears driving toward, right? Where are they going, right? Oh, and once you figure that out, then you can change your policies to match your goals.
Yeah, to see, you're raising some complex theoretical issues now, though. See, Stuart Hall says race is the modality in which class lives. Class is modality in which race lives. So that race and class, that predatory capitalism driving it, but it couldn't drive it without the systemic racism at a particular moment. And both are changing over time. Capitalism never stays the same. It's dynamic. Race.
That's right.
Same brother Winnett and Omi taught us that. I don't know when that book came out. When was that, in the
80s? In the late 80s, I think,
On racial formation.
25 years. Racial formation was, it was 25th anniversary a few years ago. So I think it might have been the 90s then. But it's a while ago.
Yeah, but it's a very important book. Very important book. Where that race, class have to go hand in hand. The predatory capitalism and white supremacy must be always understood in relation to each other.
Yeah. No, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, again, the Stuart Hall's emphasis about the role of, you know, cultural narrative in, you know, obscuring and normalizing and creating consent and, you know, support for things that are frankly, you know, very hard to develop consent when you only have a behavior and action that's associated with it. You need a set of ideas that and ideologies that have to propel it. And, absolutely. You know, that came up earlier today with Representative Omar, right? In terms of America First. Well, what exactly does that mean? But in terms of, you know, the Tulsa, you know, again, it's important that we not say, well, you know, something like what happens to George Floyd or what happens to Eric Garner or what happens to Sandra Bland or what happens to Breonna Taylor are somehow the antithesis, because those are criminalized in the case of, you know, Garner, you know, sort of street economy, selling individual cigarettes to try to create, you know, an economic opportunity when there isn't any. And Wall Street, Black Wall Street being this flourishing thing, on the surface, they look like opposites. But it's extremely important to think about what exactly the outcomes are going to be. And so we have to see the criminal justice system as a financial boon, as a hallmark of predatory capitalism. But it's hiding under the ideological framework of criminalization.
I'm telling you, you're getting deep on me. You're getting deep on me, but I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, there's a sense in which, at least for me, you know, the bottom line is, even when you keep track of predatory capitalism and white supremacy as a system, it's cowardly murder done when people think they can get away with it. So that whatever the legal system is, they were deputized to kill Black people in Tulsa. Right? The police killing Floyd and thinking he can get away with it. So that's a continuity, and that's cowardice.
That's right. That's right.
The deepest level. But then once we bring in an even more subtle systemic analysis, we can see the ways in which the legal system lets them off. The economic system is still designed in such a way that there's no accountability even for the people gaining access to capital and credit and resources just to be able to live with dignity, with their housing and their jobs and school systems and so forth. Neighborhood and what have you. Wow. Wow. This office hours today. It's really getting quite theoretic.
Well, school's in session, brother. Oh, we're not keeping our 6 feet of distance. We going in.
I'm telling you, bring your Du Bois, bring your Kimberly Crenshaw, bring your Tricia
Michael
Rose.
Omi and Winant. Yep. Bring Stuart Hall.
You're going to bring your text. Lord have mercy.
Well, I'm sure you've told many a student not to come to your office hours without a book in mind, although I bet you have the book memorized when it's time to tell them what is it. Well, just go to page 48. The piece you're looking for is on page 48. Unbelievable. Well, thank you, Cornell.
Thank you
for
so
riveting conversation as always. And I think we have to always. And we're really delighted to have had a special takeover episode with Intelligence Squared. And we look forward to partnering with them again in the future. And we want the fans of each group to join each other's network. So Intelligence Squared people, come on over to the Tightrope. We promise we'll give you a safety net. And the Tightrope people, go over and check out Intelligence Squared. They know how to debate for real over there. All the links you'll need are in the description of this episode to join each other's communities. Also, just a quick reminder that we want you to join us on election night for our live watch party between 8:30 and midnight Eastern time. Election night, live watch party, the Tightrope, between 8:30 and midnight. We have a great group of guests lined up, some people who we need to hear more from. Marianne Williamson, Bhaskar Sankara from Jacobin Magazine, Eddie Glaude, Ashley Woodard Henderson, Kashama Sawant, Father Flager from Chicago. And I've been told by Dr. West that's the south side of Chicago. And also Christian Scott. So go to our YouTube channel for the Tightrope Pod. Set a reminder so that we can notify you when we go live and you can join us. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to our audio podcast, share this episode with your friends, and subscribe to the YouTube channel so that you can keep up with all the kinds of things we're doing on the Tightrope. It's great to have you with us. Thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you, Cornel West, for bringing the heat and the love and the fire.
Hey, Tightrope family. This is Jeremy Berry, co-executive producer of the Tightrope Podcast. Dr. West, Professor Rose, and our team are excited to inform you about a special offer coming your way. On Tuesday, November 10th, the professors will be holding an exclusive live office hours segment of the Tightrope, and you can participate. Simply visit patreon.com/thetightropepod and join our new Patreon family, where we offer a more intimate connection to the professors through offerings such as the November 10th office hours. Both new and existing patrons are eligible to join, and you'll be able to submit questions and listen in on the dialogue between Dr. West and Professor Rose. A few patrons will even get to ask their questions directly and engage in a bit of dialogue with our esteemed host. Visit patreon.com/thetightropepod to join the family. We'll post details about the offer in the coming weeks. As always, stay strong and stay on the tightrope.